the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. She was a doctoral candidate here in sociology and completed her doctoral degree, what is it, 2 years ago, 18 months? 2 years ago. And she is currently a professor in sociology at Wilfrid Laurier University. She has done extensive work with international development agencies specializing or focusing particularly on women's issues. And we are looking forward very much to what she has to tell us today about women's struggles in Nigeria. Patience.
Thank you. At times, you know, when an introduction has been made, you become very scared if you can really fit into the shoes. But, you know, I will try my best. Basically, what I'm going to be talking about today is Nigerian women's struggles. And the reason for choosing this is that I'm basically tired of hearing third world women, African women, being presented as submissive, passive, doing nothing to help themselves. In most literature that you find on third world women or African women, the tendency is for them to be presented as people who are helpless and not able to do anything for themselves. So I decided to give a talk on Nigerian women's struggles against all kinds of subordination or oppression or, you know, political practices that are oppressive to them, economic situations that they don't have control over. How are they able to survive in spite of such oppressive or exploitative economic situations? And how basically are they holding their own and their societies together? And I thought, you know, I should give a little bit of background of Nigerian women. And hopefully at the end of the day, you will see that in as much as it appears as if they are suffering, yes, they are, but they are also struggling within that to make sure that the oppressive situation that they are subjected to are alleviated. In order to do that, I decided to look at two historical moments in the history of Nigeria. And basically, those two moments will reflect the fact that women have basically been very strong. Nigerian women, I mean, have basically been very strong. Well, the two moments I'm referring to are, one, the Aba Women's Riot, that we basically hear of as the Women's War. And then the next moment is the Nigerian Women's Union and its fight against all kinds of oppressive practices then. So, well, let me begin by talking a little bit about the Aba Women's Riot. Aba Women's Riot, you know, took place in 1929. But it came up as a result of a culmination of all kinds of things that women could not take anymore. Prior to colonial domination, prior to 1929, of course, we found that women were basically autonomous to some extent. In as much as the society was patrilinear, women still had their own section within the societies where they were able to discuss issues that affected them. The Aba Women's Riot, although it affected the southeastern part of Nigeria, it basically had its impact for women all over Nigeria. At that particular point in time, women were basically not allowed to participate in formally recognized political institutions. But they were able to organize themselves into associations. And such associations focused on two issues. One, first of all, at least to discuss each other's problems, you know, with regards to how to survive, you know, marital stress or stuff like that. And then the other one was centered around age group or I think we have what you call the age group associations, you know, in Nigeria, where members of the same age group, say 3 years age difference, could get together and participate in ceremonies, rituals, or what have you. But basically, that was a social thing for them to do. And for them, it was a way of, you know, continuing to maintain their identities. One of the things that happened then was that it was quite common for women to relocate when they got married. And as such, you know, they belong to two families. Their marital homes, where they basically did not have too much power. You know, the only thing they had rights to there was usufruct right to land. And then they also had their natal homes, where, of course, they still had their families and belonged there. So their role as wives was to kind of organize some kind of harmony between their natal homes and their marital homes. But most of their status came from their natal home. While in their marital homes, it was after they gave birth to male sons or male children that they achieved some kind of status. Though they did not have you know, right to property within their marital homes, their sons had rights to property. So, anyway, for the longest of time, this association started out initially for discussing personal issues and then subsequently expanded to discussing social issues, how the societies were organized, and to some extent, they still raising an awareness to the fact that they were excluded from political power. Through further organizing, these women started trying to create space for themselves by agitating for more voices. They were basically not oppressed in the way that we hear of. They had their own sections, and they were leaders, and you know, did all they engaged in trade. They were economically independent within the, you know, within even their husband's home. They participated in agricultural production a lot, and whatever, you know, they traded in, they were able to keep, you know, their funds or their money. So they really were not oppressed the way we now talk about oppression. But they still realized that they were marginalized within the political sphere. So they started agitating for a little bit of space. But this was the situation until the colonial administration came in. And when the colonial administration came in, they set up a different system under what you call the warrant system of administration. Under this warrant system of education, women were completely excluded from any form of power. The autonomy that they had initially, you know, was more or less erased. The trade in which they engaged in found that, you know, prices of the crops or the commodities that they were trading, the prices were slashed, which basically meant that their economic independence was challenged. And of course, you know, the warrant officers also abused these women by exploiting them, you know, especially when they came to those women who were seeking divorce for reasons that I cannot explain, were tortured by the warrant officers. They were ridiculed and, you know, basically, you know, given a hard time. So this system kind of continued. And one other thing it did was that it took power and gave to the men who became their sycophants. By that, there were men who were very conspicuous, who were sucking up to them. And in order to, they gave them power, you know, of administration. And these men now took it out on the women. So it wasn't just the colonial administrators. Their sycophants or their representatives were also vested with the power to exploit the women. At times, you know, some of the food crops that they produced were seized by these men, you know, so it became impossible for the women to at least have some element of control over their lives and their product. In addition to that, too, even men were also oppressed within the system. So let me not make it look as if it's only women that were oppressed. Men who were of the lower classes were oppressed. And these were husbands to these women. So it was like a case of double whammy. The poor men were oppressed and the women themselves were oppressed. On top of that, a tax system was introduced. And since a lot of, some of these men, or most of these men, were not working, it was the women who were traders who had the money, they were paying taxes for their husbands, as well as their sons and their brothers. And this tax system became a little bit cumbersome for them. If their trade wasn't going too well and they were having to pay taxes for their husbands and sons and brothers, it became quite a problem for them. But rumors, you know, were spread that women were going to be taxed subsequently. And of course, I believe this struck a very wrong nerve. And the result was, you know, a massive, massive revolt by women. The story goes that, you know, a warrant officer had gone to the household of a woman in a polygamous setting and was trying to count the number of wives in that household as well as the property that they had. And this woman objected to his doing that. So they engaged in exchange of words and subsequently engaged in physical combat. And the result of this was, you know, other women who were in the compound holding a meeting, basically talking about the tax system, heard. And they all came out and sat on the man. You know, the sitting-in system basically started at that time. I call it sitting or sit-on, whichever way. But it doesn't really mean, there have been different interpretations given to this. Others say, you know, you sit on the man's head, but I don't believe that's true. The women just basically sit down, refuse to go until their demands were met. And what they did, while they were sitting, others were going to neighboring villages to inform other women that they now had proof that the tax system for women was going to be implemented. If this man came in to enumerate the poor people in the house, that was an indication that the women were going to be taxed. So this news, I mean, re-echoed from village to village. And before you know it, women from all villages came out and organized a massive, massive protest. As a matter of fact, this was the beginning of the war, because it continued. The women kept demanding for other things, the erosion of the warrant system of administration, all kinds of things. As a matter of fact, even the leaders, they had cases against the leaders who they felt, you know, were exploiting them and taking a lot of their products for free. So all kinds of corruptive practices that were going on, women started highlighting them and demanding that changes be made. They also started demanding that they wanted to be members of the administration, of the council, and so on and so forth. So it boomeranged into all kinds of things. And at the end of it, you know, this probably took place for about 2 years. A lot of women were killed, about 50 women. Record says 50 women died in the process. But the warrant officers also lost a lot of their property, their prestige, and so on and so forth. And as a result of this, the massive unrest was becoming too much for the colonial administration, and they basically had to step in and make certain changes. So let me basically highlight some of the changes that took place as a result of... what did the women's war achieve? First of all, the women were now assured that no taxation of women was ever intended at that time, and they also succeeded in delaying the introduction of taxes into Eastern Nigeria until 1950. This war took place in 1929. So basically, at least that was a major achievement. They forced the colonial administration to recognize that many of the warrant chiefs were corrupt and despotic. The women themselves brought forward cases of alleged corruption against warrant chiefs. As a result of this upheaval, of course, the colonial administration set up a commission of inquiry. That's always what they do. And that report was released, and basically one of the issues raised was that they criticized the Nigerian administration with regards to its taxation policy. It has been very, very severe. So they recommended that policy be abandoned. One other thing that came out of the women's uprising or war was that the warrant officers were removed, and then traditional leaders were vested with the power to at least lead the communities. Moreover, you know, the native courts that were ridiculing women were completely reorganized, and a few women even became members of several groups within the court. so that, you know, it can be seen that the women succeeded in their objective, and in so doing brought about far-reaching changes in the colonial administration. But that is not to say that, you know, gave women so much power. It was the spur of the moment thing, and soon after, although you had other protests taking place since that time, you find that women have not been able to collect or get that same momentum that they did at that time. And as such, you know, subsequent protests have not quite achieved the same result. But as you can see, this was the beginning of a women's movement in Nigeria that we don't always want to talk about. When we hear of the women's movement, we want to think that it started in the 60s as a result of what started in the West. But this was something that took place, you know, years gone by. In 1930, you know, there was also another uprising by women. But like I said, it wasn't as big as the Aba women's movement. And then in 1940, you also had a similar kind of uprising, but at a lower level, the same with the 50s. That takes me to the next moment in Nigerian history, and this was in the 50s, you know, when a woman called Mrs. Ransom Kuti, Olufunlayo Ransom Kuti, who is from the southwestern. What I had described took place in southeastern Nigeria. Ransom Kuti's movement, you know, started in southwestern Nigeria. And she started from a very, very small village, you know, called Abeokuta, I believe, you know, in Egba land. And what she did was to gather a group of women together to form what you call the Abeokuta Women's League. Let me read. Yeah, she called it Abeokuta Ladies Club. And the purpose initially of setting up this club was to carry out humanitarian services. We were doing things like catering and cooking and sewing, you know. But subsequently, you know, this club became very, very popular because the membership, you know, started to grow, to her surprise, I guess. And subsequently, it was changed. The name of the association was changed to the Abeokuta Women's Union. And of course, when something becomes unionized, as it is here, you find that it becomes a little bit more radical. At this point, you know, the market women in that region were beginning to grumble. They were dissatisfied with, again, the prices of crops that were set by the government in collusion with the traditional leader that they refer to as the Alake. And I believe, you know, well, the Alake is a king, so to speak, in his own right. You know, but we will call them traditional. For the purpose of this discussion, I'll say the traditional leader. As a result of mass enrollment within this group, we found the market women, who were already agitated, decided to join this movement and were demanding for some form of education. They wanted to be educated. So the purpose of this movement now spread into literacy. We're now carrying out some kind of literacy program. So of course, you know, we're beginning to see now education evolving, and that means power. Through this education, a lot of these women were beginning to ask why it was that, you know, they were excluded from the administration of that region. And of course, Mrs. Ransom Kuti is somebody who was highly educated. You know, and of course, you know, she explained to them why the situation was like this. But when the colonial administration decided to set up a new kind of system called, similar to the warrant system that I mentioned before in the eastern region, the development of this kind of a system robbed women again of a lot of power. Their autonomy again was destroyed, and even price controls were instituted. And the market women, who were already grumbling, you know, now saw that as a major, major threat to them and their economic basis. So various groups within the market women will protest in bits and pieces until 1947, I believe. when a massive demonstration took place, over 20,000 market women, you know, took to the street, and in addition to that, they had marched to the palace of the Alake, the traditional chief, basically challenging his support of the administrative system that was exploitative to them. But in addition to that, they accused him directly, because apparently a lot of the women did not like his face, you know, and his practices. He was seen as an exploiter himself, and they took the liberty of telling him exactly what they felt about him. And of course, you know, he didn't take them very seriously. So they organized what you call a sit-in for 12 hours and went to their homes. 2 days later, they organized another sit-in for 48 hours. And each time they came back, they stayed for longer period. And while sitting, they would sing very abusive songs, you know, and they would challenge his manhood. At one point, they demonstrated a mock funeral rite for him, you know, as if he was dead. They were burying him, and all of this, you know, he was hearing. They were not only asking that changes be made within the administration of the land, they were asking for him to abdicate from his seat. And of course, you know, he didn't take them seriously, but each time they went back, they were stronger than ever before. This continued until one of their last rallies, I believe, also, I think it was in December, when a group of young men, you know, now started joining forces with the women, saying that, you know, they thought what the women had to say was important and that they deserved to be heard. And with men joining forces with the women, of course, violence broke out within the society. And again, you know, a lot of force was used to try to calm them down, but this did not deter the women from demanding for their rights. Subsequently, when the, according to him, you know, the women were constituting a nuisance, I mean, he finally succumbed to, you know, their demands and cancelled or challenged the warrant system again, the type of warrant system that was there, and shifted power from the warrant administration to traditional leaders. By this time, his traditional supporters or leaders, what you call the chiefs, were already quite unhappy with him for waiting that long to take action. So what happened was, when he traveled out on vacation for a month or so, the traditional chiefs, you know, colluded with the women, the, you know, women demonstrators, and overthrew him, more or less. But he did come back. When he came back, you know, he decided to resign from being the head of the political administration, but become the chairman of some other organization that was also going to be oppressive to the women. But the women refused and said they just wanted him out. Funny enough, you know, he stayed for another 2 months. You know, and on the 28th of July, 1948, the violence, the nature of the violence that broke out was too much, and he had no choice but to leave. And when he left, of course, you know, I know there's been a lot of stories that have gone on in Nigeria. I have no proof, and I didn't, you know, I couldn't include it, but I'll tell the story anyway. It was alleged that the leader of the women's union, the Abeokuta Women's Union, actually slapped, you know, the chief. I don't know, that's a rumor. I heard that as a kid growing up, but that's an aside. That's how much power she had generated, you know, and therefore, a traditional leader to abdicate a seat because of women's movement, for me, it's unheard of. But that was a very powerful thing to do. And, you know, several things came out of this protest. First of all, the women were given a lot of coverage by the media. It was something unheard of, you know. Mrs. Kuti attended as many conferences, press conferences as possible, talking about this issue. And again, you know, as a result of the achievements that came out of this movement, her Abeokuta Women's Union changed subsequently a year or two later into Nigerian Women's Union. So it went from a smaller group to a bigger thing. You know, and that movement or that union is still very active within the Nigerian situation. Although we find that other women's movements or groups have overtaken it, I believe it's still in existence. Mrs. Ransom Kuti finally died, I think, about 3-4 years ago, I believe. But, you know, her name is down in history as one of the very, very, very dominant and progressive women in Nigeria. There are many other movements that I could talk about, but these were the two major, major ones that culminated in a lot of changes, at least to some extent, with regards to women's positions. They not only talked about, you know, political issues, they were also concerned about women's education. They talked about, you know, women's rights within the system. So, you know, that kind of laid the groundwork for other organizations to evolve. There was another organization that's also involved called the Women's People's Party or something that also came out or arose as a matter of, as a result of Mrs. Ransom Kuti's position, but it was in opposition with the Abeokuta Women's Union because those were women who didn't believe that the radical approach was the right approach. They believed that, you know, there's a traditional way to go, less dialogue, and gradually we'll find our way. But movements like that, you know, were known to exist. But in 1959, I believe, you know, the National Council of Nigerian Women, you know, which is the recognized women's group or umbrella group in Nigeria, was instituted. And some of the women who were part of these other movements also became instrumental in the formation of that. But one thing about that particular council is that, you know, it is government recognized and government sponsored. And we all know, you know, that anything government, you know, has its limitations. That is not to say they don't have much to say, but, like, again, people are very suspicious. One characteristic of this particular National Women's Council is that, you know, it is very elitist. You know, it's made up of a lot of educated women who believe that they know women's problems and as such can help in solving women's problems. That is a major mistake because, you know, if you haven't experienced what it is to be poor at the grassroots, you cannot speak for people. And that is one of the reasons why, you know, membership of that organization does not include market women nor people at the grassroots level. But it is still very much there. If you go to Nigeria, that will be the organization you will be introduced to. But now it serves as an umbrella organization for a lot of smaller organizations. I don't remember the membership of that umbrella organization. But, you know, people who are also or who haven't been satisfied with that have set up other kinds of organizations. I think there's a proliferation of organizations and movements, women's movements within Nigeria. Most of them, I don't know. I've not been home in about 3-4 years, so I'm sure there are 1,001 that have arisen. But let me talk about, you know, in the 90s, the kind of organization, again, that also was instituted, late 80s, mid-80s to 90s, where the president's wife, you know, for the first time, you know, thought she was in a position to set up an organization that would address women's issues. She called it Better Life for Rural Dwellers. I believe that's the name she called it initially. And it was an avenue, according to her, to empower women, to talk about women's equality, to address the issue of women's equality, and also to address the exploitation of women. But this organization, again, is something set up by a member of the elite, which, of course, you know, a lot of people cannot, you know, identify with. As an example, you know, in as much as she claims, or as this organization claims to look or care for women's issues, you find that, you know, it does not really know what is going on at the grassroots level. As an example, there was a year where they had, not just a year, they kept organizing all kinds of meetings from state to state. We had about 20 states as at the time I left Nigeria. I think we have about 30 states now or more. She would go from state to state, you know, organizing women's groups. Basically, she was based in Lagos, and the governor's wives in each of the states were organizing the state level of this association. But each time they said they had an exhibit, they would dress up women. You know, rural women they've never had anything to do with. They would bring them to the table and decorate them and have this big ceremony about how women are doing well. I remember in 91 when I went home, I attended one of the sessions. And I know a lot of the women farmers because I had worked as an extension officer in Nigeria. And I approached them and I said, what do you know about what is going on? They said, we don't know. They gave us dresses to dress up and we asked to bring our food. And here we are, you know, with them, displaying them. We're obeying the president's wife. And I said, but before now, did you get any funding for your agri production? And they said, nope. But out of this gathering, we have clothes. We're given these clothes to wear. And, you know, I became very suspicious, as many other, you know, women in Nigeria would, very suspicious of her intentions. As a matter of fact, you know, this whole thing became quite international because she got a lot of foreign aid to support this better life for rural dwellers. But my question is, who has benefited from that? I don't believe that, you know, it's the women that were said to have benefited from it that did. But there's been a lot of, again, counter organizations to this. And I will address myself to the one I feel is really a people's organization. What you call the Country Women's Association of Nigeria. That one was an organization I believe that was set up under a woman called B.C. Ogunleye, or Deleye. She's based in Ibadan. And what she did was to address the issue of women's access to production resources, agricultural production resources. Women have been increasingly denied access to land as a result of what you've all heard of here as structural adjustment policy. I don't want to address that this evening, but I know conferences after conferences that a lot of you here have attended, you've heard of all the negative things happening to women. But I've come here to talk about the positive things, so I'm not going to talk about the negative things. But women don't have access to land, they don't have access to credit, they don't have access to other production resources. This organization is a group of women who have collectively decided to buy land for production of crops. The organizations are located in various regions of Nigeria. They do buy a lot of land, they produce crops, for feeding themselves first. And then whatever surplus is left, they use, you know, they sell in the market and then divide whatever gains they get from it. But such an organization, as you see, is not very popular. It's not a popular organization because it consists of grassroots women. Women who are basically empowering themselves through at least doing things their own way, not really, it's a top, it's a bottom up approach. The woman who is running this organization has been brought to all kinds of conferences here in North America again to talk about the issues and the kinds of difficult situations that she's faced. But one oppressive situation I know is she faced is that, you know, she was almost imprisoned by the Nigerian government because of the fact that, you know, she had spoken against the president's wife who was running the other organization. And apart from that, on one of the occasions when the president's wife was carrying out her propaganda through the rural women dwellers, whatever her association is, she had borrowed women who were members of this other woman's organization and brought them, you know, for decorative purposes. You know, to decorate tables and give the impression that she was the one helping them. And this woman protested vehemently. You know, she organized her group and said no woman should go to that display. And again, you know what this meant? It meant public embarrassment for the president's wife and her entourage. And as a result of this public display, you know, she was arrested and locked up. But again, her women organized what we call a sit-in. You know, we won't want to call it sitting now, but they went, you know, and demonstrated before the state governor's house and demanded that she be released. And so subsequently released, and she's still very much, you know, doing her thing. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, we are seeing women playing prominent role in demanding for changes of conditions that affect their lives. There's an increased focus now. When you talk about development discourse and people are suggesting alternatives and visions and strategies, they're talking about women organizing themselves to alleviate themselves from the situation. My story is that women have always organized themselves. It is not a new phenomenon. And for us to think that it is starting now as a result of the fact that feminism all over the world is focusing on that, it's a problem. Women have always organized themselves, and they will continue to organize themselves. And the impression also that women don't work, you know, is another issue that I want to address. Women in Nigeria have always worked. If you go to the history, if you look at the history books of Nigeria, you find that women, either by virtue of being polygamous, have been responsible for their children. And it means working. There's nobody who's going to do the work, so they've always worked. Women have the energy to work if given the chance. The only thing is that, you know, those resources that they use for working are increasingly taken away from them. And that is what we should fight for, that they should have access to their resources. And they are okie-dokie. They work, you know, at least. They don't care. They don't depend on anybody to come and feed them. But when those resources are not there, which is what the structural adjustment is doing, is giving them, you know, more intensive kind of labor. When they don't have land, they're having to sell their labor in the big plantation. And that means more work for them. They are putting in 16 hours of work each day. And it means we are breaking them. Their natural power bases are being broken. And as such, you know, they are being marginalized. And they are increasingly becoming dependent on a system that has failed them. By that I mean, you know, well, they try to depend on their husbands who don't have jobs. Structural adjustment, as a result of that, a lot of husbands have lost jobs and have become even added mouths for the women to feed. Yet, you know, we don't have a welfare system there that provides for them. But on the other hand, the women are stronger, you know, and I, you know, keep wondering, you know, where they get their energy. They are never daunted. They keep looking for ways to deal with the situation. I just mentioned the issue of collective bargaining of land. You know, they buy their land collectively and then they produce. One other thing I know has happened in past years is that there's what we call the people's bank that has been set up, where women in collectives can now go to banks to get loans. So at least they've also made a headway there, and a lot of the grassroots women are now having access to credit. It's not enough, but they are doing something. So that's another area where I find that, you know, Nigerian women have done a lot of work. But on the opposite end, what are the women academics doing? You know, I believe maybe I fall into that category, as are others who go out to talk. They are going to every conference and strategizing. They are forming partnerships with all kinds of groups, you know, bringing their issues to the world. This is not a time to hide anything under the table. We are discussing our issues everywhere. Women have become increasingly very, very political. The only thing is that, again, you know, the top-down approach is problematic. In as much as I speak whatever I'm saying with my grandma, now when I go back home, the women at the grassroots accept me very easily, because again, they see me as somebody who doesn't understand their experiences. And that's where, you know, we as academics have to really try to break the barrier, so that you can see that we are working hand in hand. And, you know, while they are coming from the bottom, we are coming from the middle. I don't say myself, from the middle. And hopefully, you know, collectively, we'll be able to gather enough energy. When I hear consciousness raising, I don't talk about that, because the consciousness of Nigerian women have always been raised. The question of saying we are raising their consciousness now does not apply. So my mother, her consciousness, you know, is better than mine sitting here. So I don't believe that we need to raise their consciousness. And then with regards to the issue of poverty, which I believe, you know, is the thing that breaks people's back, women have learned to also survive even under such conditions. In 1991, I heard the formula that they said they had developed for eating, you know, 001 or 011. That, you know, people have developed a sense of humor. You know, 001 means no breakfast, no lunch, and there's a dinner or 010, no breakfast, heavy lunch, and a dinner. You know, and a good sense of humor, you know. The leadership role in Nigeria, from the eastern part of Nigeria. But again, you know, there were a lot of pressures on her, and said that, you know, maybe that led to her death. She did not quite accomplish all she wanted to do during her lifetime. But she made her mark as a troublesome woman within the traditional leadership by demanding that more women, you know, became traditional leaders. I have pictures and pictures of women. But pictures or no pictures, you know, these days we don't have heroes that we can think of, about now as women who are fighting in the struggle. But you find that the grassroots women are the people who are basically taking control of their life, taking control of the situation, and demanding for change. There's nothing as good as group action. There's nothing as good as group action or group approach to political movement. People who came in from Nigeria, you know, for this African Studies Association conference that just ended, we're talking about the issue of democracy, which is basically another avenue now for us demanding for emancipation of people in general and women in particular. And the democratic process taking place in Nigeria now is not democratic at all. Last year, as most of you are aware of, there was a quasi election that took place in Nigeria. Up until now, I believe that leader has not been allowed to rule. He's actually in jail right now, you know, for reasons that a lot of us don't have control over. Because of the fact that Nigeria has been led by a military regime for years, I believe, you know, in the past 30 years, Nigeria has been led by a military regime. And this has, you know, escalated, you know, the violence against people in general and women in particular. Inasmuch as, you know, women have created their own space, they are working within certain limitations because of the fact that they are afraid of persecution, you know, first by the military, and secondly by the fact that a lot of husbands who have lost their jobs, who do you think they take their anger out on? The women basically who are in the house. It may not be a deliberate thing, but you know, it's coming out that way. You know, and the academics, you know, like, that I mentioned before, are taking this up as an issue. That, you know, the violence facing women has escalated and are looking for avenues to deal with that. For the longest of time, because of the patriarchal system in Nigeria, violence was seen as a way of disciplining women. They will tell you, you know, it's traditional. You use tradition to support the fact that, you know, it was easy for them to get away. But I think increasingly now I'm beginning to see the fact that it has become quite an issue in the Nigerian society, where, you know, when you are talking where a Nigerian man is, standing and he says, oh please, before I say anything now, you are going to say that, you know, I'm abusing you. So they are becoming very conscious of the fact that there's a limit to, you know, where they can carry, you know, their violence to. So at least the consciousness of both men and women to the issue of violence is becoming quite prominent, and I'm quite happy about that. Then the issue of democracy, the question is, whose democracy are we talking about? Is it democracy for the people in general, or is it democracy for men again, or is it democracy for men and women? That has also become an issue where women are not particularly interested in voting for members of the political parties because, you know, no matter what, when they are there, they still don't discuss the issue that affects women's lives. But women on their own are also running for political positions. I noticed that in the last, second to the last election, women featured prominently in the political system. I don't know how well they succeeded, but at least the fact that they are now coming out of their shell to participate in the political system shows that, you know, they are becoming part and parcel of a movement to overthrow the patriarchal setting that is going on. I will stop there, you know, because I want people to ask questions so we can, you know, discuss. Thank you. Agriculture still forms the basis of the economy in Nigeria, and a lot of women, you know, produce for their household consumption and take some of their produce to the market for exchange, you know, for sale, so they can generate enough money to purchase commodities that they don't produce. The market women, for a very long time, were not seen as a powerful group of people until, you know, they formed themselves into a big association, and they meet, you know, quite often, you know, to discuss issues of non-access to resources. Their association at times is responsible for, you know, contributing money to a common purse where members can borrow, you know, some money to use for, you know, immediate needs or emergencies. So they become quite powerful today. They have generated power within the community where, when they come out as a collective to fight against any particular practice, that practice is basically either discontinued or revived. As a typical example, in 1991, when the Parents Teachers Association instituted a fine of five naira for children to bring to school to contribute to the common purse, the women said, "What for? Why should we contribute that kind of money, unless, you know, you can tell me that what you're going to use it for is going to benefit me or my child, then, you know, I'm not going to contribute." But as a result of their challenge, that was discontinued. Then 2-3 months later, the school itself, instituted some kind of levy on the students. And when the children got home and told their parents about it, the market women again abandoned their wares in the market and marched straight to the traditional leader's house. I'm talking of Benin in particular. They marched straight to the traditional leader's palace and demanded that that levy be erased. Otherwise, you know, society was going to see their red eyes. And believe me, within the question of 2-3 hours, you know, that levy was removed, because the traditional leader sent a message to the governor, who in turn sent a message to the school to say, "Look, you are asking for trouble." You have a lot of market women that have formed the market, the powerful base within the society. If they refuse to sell wares in the market, then which food are people going to feed on? So, you know, they use that. That could be a form of, you know, controlling, you know, the economy of the society. When they also, as women, go back to their respective homes and refuse to cook for their husbands, that's another thing. You know, so they have a lot of power. Bottom-up power that we don't seem to realize, but they are beginning to realize that power is enough if they join forces together to overthrow any system. And they tend to use it when things get very bad. So those are the women that they're not necessarily very educated. They're economically very independent, you know, because at least they have control over the produce which they sell or which they produce and sell. So to some extent, they form a power group within the society. Does that answer your question? Yes.
This is historically, women in Africa have been located to organize around environmental and infrastructure. And it's becoming more profound now because of things where it's given the transnational differences in culture on local environment. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about you seeing that.
Well, it is happening, except that it's not as prominent as the Green Belt. She has brought that movement to the Green Belt movement has become quite popular in Kenya. I don't think we've developed to that extent yet in Nigeria. Although, you know, the government, you know, goes on propaganda all the time, telling people to plant trees. But I don't think women have consciously taken it up as an issue. But the one thing I know is that women in Nigeria have always had some respect for the environment. The kinds of practices they carry out in their farm is a shifting kind of cultivation where, you know, any piece of land used this year is left next year to fallow. So they have respect, this respect, mutual respect for the environment, and I believe they are still doing that. The multinational corporations are also getting into Nigeria, and they are the ones cutting down the trees. Unfortunately, most analysis that you see blame these women, you know, for lack of respect. But I believe they have respect for the environment, but have not taken conscious effort to carry out the kind of replanting of trees that is carried out in Kenya.
Tell us a little about the education of young girls.
Well, it's like the case of last hired, first fired, same thing with kids or with female children. Once the economy goes wrong, of course, they are the first to be withdrawn from schools. There was a time when the universal primary education was introduced in Nigeria under one of the political leaders, Obafemi Awolowo, and education was basically free then. So men, boys and girls, you know, went to school. But under the current situation that we have, school fees has been introduced back into the educational system. And of course, it means that, you know, some children can go to school and some children cannot. Because of the high value placed on male children in most African societies, including Nigeria, it is the male children that are kept in school. And the female children are the first to be withdrawn when the family has to decide who is to go to school. So that may not be too, at least, you know, I believe that female children still get up to primary six education. But after that, there's no guarantee that you know, they are going to get higher education. In few cases, you know, where because of the communal system and the kinship system, you find that older children from families help to sponsor the education of younger children. When they've had their own education and they have jobs, they help to sponsor younger children. So to some extent, maybe that is helping. But generally, you find that the female children that get whisked away from school first. But this varies from region to region within Nigeria. I cannot generalize for the whole of Nigeria, but it varies from region to region and the value that they place on girls. On the other hand, attitudes towards girls are also changing. I must say that. Because in recent years, I believe families are also beginning to realize that female children are very sympathetic to their parents, to their elders. And as such, you know, those who, despite the hard conditions, still try as much as possible to give the female children the best that they can. But when faced with terrible conditions, the male children get out of the system. Yeah. Has never been proven really that matriarchy, you know, existed. There are still evidence, people are still trying to prove that. But yes, at one point, I wouldn't call it matriarchy, because these women were basically also married, except that they had their own autonomy within the marriage system. And, you know, when their husbands were kings, they were queens. So, you know, when their husbands had positions of authority within traditional society, they had something parallel to that. And there were certain meetings that were held within such communities where women's contribution was very important. So, you know, yes, it may have happened amongst the Yorubas, but not only the Yorubas, the Igbos, I understand, also, you know, had that kind of a practice. So, yes, in various parts of Nigeria, you had chiefs and queens. Actually, you had a Queen Amina, you know, from the northern part of Nigeria, who was said to have been a ruler in her own right and dominated both men and women. She was regarded as a very aggressive, actually I have a picture of her here, as a very, very aggressive ruler who acquired the traits of male rulers. But yes, you know, there are cases of, but matriarchy, no, I don't believe that. Unless if there's any other Nigerian here who can correct me, I don't believe we had a matriarchy. In Ghana, yes, you know, we can talk about that, but Nigeria, no. Yes. If I may ask, how many girls benefit from such a program, considering the population of Nigeria and the population of girls within Nigeria? Is it?
What I'm saying is, you have to start in somewhere. And this particular program is taking care of a small group now. But, you know, it's on an experimental stage now. But as the time goes on, I think it's going to work out, but they are trying to experiment. And in this particular woman, this independent one that got the so they are now working towards a program where they can have women commission. So that's the thing they are working towards. To look after women.
Actually, I believe the Women's Commission was set up and headed by Bolanle Awe at one time, but I understand she's been thrown out because she was too political. I don't know the details, but apparently she did not fit in within the mandate of what was supposed to, the kind of empowerment she wanted for women, I understand, is quite different from what's on the agenda. I, to be honest, I have a problem with when special units are set up for women, especially in Nigeria. Because what it does is that, you know, any problem that women face, they tell you go to the women's unit. So it's a way of creating a marginalized form of section for women. You know, the social welfare, whatever, used to be responsible for women's issues. And if you went to the mainstream ministries, they would tell you go to the Ministry of Welfare. For me, it seems as if it's a politics of marginalization. Why is it that you don't have to carve out the special women's unit? Why is it that women's unit is not a component of every other unit, every other ministry within the country? You know, when you start putting people in a group, it becomes very problematic. It's just my reaction to it. I'm not saying that it's not a good step. Yes.
Yes, and just to add to that, I think we also need to talk about the economic effect and education. Mm-hmm. I think one of the consequences of social justice, for example, has been the impact, the negative impact that it's had on education, especially for young women and girls, family, from the military. At least in the case of Ghana, very local, the government group.
It's increasing.
And then because household heads who have most of the men have made choices when it comes to credits of economic cash, cash of child, the kind of
And apart from that, we reduced allocation to education, to the educational sector. It means it can't take in the same number of people that it could. And basically, it would prefer taking in the young men than overtaking in the young women. Yes. Actually, I thought I brought a book written by them. There's a book that they wrote. This is a group of academics, women academics, basically located in various institutions in Nigeria that got themselves together to challenge the mainstream National Council of Nigerian Women, because they saw those ones as not addressing the real issues. The National Council of Nigerian Women basically talks about integrating women into the system. And the women in Nigerian group saying, there's nothing here for us to integrate women into, because the structure itself is very faulty, and there's need for us to basically break it down and start something else. So they did a lot of research on women and the family, women's role in various sectors of the economy, of society, and were highly critical of the marginalization of women. But again, in response to this, the mainstream of the society has labeled them a bunch of frustrated, liberated women who have nothing better to do, you know, than sit down and make trouble. So they've been seen as a bunch of troublemakers who people don't want to identify with. And as a result, the momentum with which these women started their group initially is kind of, you know, eroded. They are still there, they're still doing research, they organize conferences, and they attend conferences to talk about women's issues. But the kind of impact that they had thought they were going to make within the country, I don't think basically has been made. Because a lot of, you know, women tend to be traditional, they've been socialized into believing that what is happening to them is natural. So when some women come in and say it's not natural, these are all socially constructed, you know, they are faced with a dilemma. And a lot of them, because they have to return home to their husbands at the end of the day and don't want to face problems, distance themselves from such situations. So yes, you know, it's there, it's still kicking, but it's not doing as well as one would have thought. A lot of members of that group have had to leave Nigeria as well. Most of them are in universities here and in the U.S. So there's nobody left to run the organization. People are trying to survive economically, so politics is secondary to that. Yes, any more questions, comments?
Thank you.